Sir?
Anastasia recognized Igmen's voice, even if she couldn't hear what he was saying. He'd come back, as she'd known he would, because he, too, knew that something was wrong. First, the young woman had disappeared. Then the property developer had given up. And now she knew what Haka was. She felt unsafe. He tried to come into her room, but she'd screamed, and although he'd begged and pleaded, he'd had to go. Yanis had been in the bathroom and hadn't heard, but even if he'd been there, she couldn't have formed the words she needed to make him understand. Now she just had to hope that the Albanian witch's son would find his mother's tarot card and understand what it meant. The breathing coming from the walls was very shallow now, the scratching non-existent. Time was short. Pemba had found Madonna weeping and bleeding outside the Divan Hotel. She'd taken refuge in there with a journalist, but then the police had tear-gassed the hotel. She'd had to get out to breathe. She'd been sick twice on the short journey to Sinem and Kerim's apartment. Once indoors, Madonna went straight to the bathroom. "She's lost her front teeth," Pemba said. She shook her head. "Bastards." Apart from a big tear in her top and some very matted hair, Pemba looked all right. Uncharitably, Sinem wondered if she'd hold up somewhere until the worst of the violence had passed. Even though she didn't have and didn't want a sexual relationship with her husband, Sinem still resented Pemba at times. "They took Madame Edith away."
"Where to?"
Pemba shrugged. "Who knows?"
"Where's Kerim?"
"At work," Sinem said. "Not Gezi, somewhere in Sultan Ahmed."
"You should call him. Ask him where Madame Edith is."
"I can't do that," Sinem said. "He won't know. He's digging a garden, trying to find the body of this missing baby."
Pemba curled her lip. "He might know."
"He won't."
She put her hand out. "Oh, give me your phone and I'll call him.
Come on."
Pemba wouldn't call from her own phone, because Kerim had said right from the start that he would never answer her calls when he was at work.
"No."
Sinem held her phone close to her chest.
"Why not?" "Because he's at work. Because I don't want to worry him."
Pemba's face reddened.
"I'm his wife," Sinem said.
"I care about you. You're only his wife in name," Pemba snapped. "Anyway, what are you getting all protective about Kerim for? You don't even like cock." Sinem looked down.
"Kerim is my best friend," she said. "We've known each other since we were children."
This time Pemba looked away. She was right. Sinem and Kerim had grown up together, and there was a love between them that went beyond sex. It was something Pemba knew she couldn't reach. She also knew that if Kerim were to have to make a choice between her and Sinem, she would be the one to go.
"All right," she said.
She looked at Sinem. Shrunken and twisted, she was in the kind of pain not even the Oromorph could touch. How could she even think about being jealous of a crippled woman who was also a lesbian? "I'm sorry, Sinem."
"It's okay."
Madonna walked into the room and lisped,
"What am I going to do about my teeth?"
The guilt was bad, but it was also useless. Pemba couldn't undo the fact that she'd spent the night with a butch gold dealer in some part of Talabasha even she'd never seen before. They'd done an awful lot of poppers, but she needed to. The gold dealer had been a brute. Pemba went over to Madonna and kissed her on the cheek.
"We'll get you implants," she said.
Madonna sat down next to Sinem, who put a hand on her knee.
"Yes." "How?"
"I don't know," Pemba said. "Maybe I'll go to that government rally this afternoon and demand compensation."
"What government rally? Where?"
"Over in the old city somewhere," Pemba said. "The unions are calling for a general strike, and so the state has to rally its forces. It'll be full of men baying for the blood of perverts."
"Us?"
"Yeah."
"Well, they won't give you any money for my teeth," Madonna said.
Pemba sighed.
"I was being ironic,"
she said. I'd be lucky if those people just threw shit at me. It was her day off, and so Mary Cox had decided to make the long journey from Bebek to Kızıl Çeşme for the government rally. It was what Ahmet Bey would have done, but he couldn't. As she covered her hair with the scarf he'd given her for her last birthday, she cried. Where was he? Was he even alive? She had felt that she had finally managed to maneuver her way into his affections, and then he'd disappeared. People meant him harm. It was the same with all men of vision. She'd seen those awful slums Ahmet Bey had redeveloped, and so she knew how much he'd improved those areas. Why did people think that was a bad thing? If Ahmet Bey had met an untimely end, would the family keep her on to look after Kelime? No one would want the child. Her mother was dead, and Ahmet Bey's siblings would probably want to sell his house to pay for Kelime to be put in a home. She couldn't argue with them. Mary took a plain brown coat out of her wardrobe and put it on. It was going to be hot outside, but if she didn't dress modestly, she'd never get into the rally. Also, she knew that Ahmet Bey preferred women to be modest. She didn't care what people said about his mistress in Moda. She had been a one-off, and Mary didn't believe he'd run away because he'd killed that woman either. He hadn't, she was sure of it. She put on a pair of flat shoes and went out of the house to get the bus to Beşiktaş. Then she'd change onto a tram. Given the traffic and all the detritus from the rioting, it would take her a few hours to get to the old city. Once there, however, she'd feel, she hoped, a little closer to Ahmet Bey. They were his people, and she admired them. Mary hoped her Turkish was good enough for her to be able to follow the speeches.
"Don't cut that down, you moron!"
Çetin Eekman grabbed the constable's arm and pulled it and the machete it held away from the mulberry bush.
"That's an ancient mulberry," he said. "You don't chop the thing up." "But how do we dig the garden if we can't knock it all down?" the man said.
Eekman raised his eyes to heaven. Then he pointed to the gnarled trunk of the bush and its deeply embedded roots. "I challenge you, Constable Baran," he said, "to find a way of burying a baby underneath this bush without damaging its root system. We're looking for disturbed ground. Get it? Disturbed ground."
"All right."
He went to the flower bed beside the bush and started to dig. "Thank you." Eekman lit a cigarette. Karim Gürsel, who had watched the altercation, came over.
"Nothing so far, sir?"
"Just morons who think that it's possible to bury the body of a baby underneath a bush without disturbing the soil," he said. "Where do they find them these days? Moran's not a child, and yet he shows no common sense at all." "I think sometimes, sir, that a lot of city boys these days just don't have any contact with agriculture. They all live in apartments, without gardens." Eekman sighed. "Yes, of course, you're right," he said. "Poor stupid bastard's probably only ever left his concrete hell to do his military service." "And that was probably in some end-of-the-world shithole that's off the map," Eekman said. "I take your point, Kerim. There's no excuse for my middle-class ravings. I'm not even middle-class."
"Ah!"
Constable Baran was holding one hand up, as if it were hurt or poisoned. Eekman said, "Have you injured yourself?" But he just screamed again. Eekman walked around the mulberry bush to the flowerbed Baran had been digging.
"What the hell is it, man?"
Kerim followed. Baran pointed at something on the ground, his eyes wide with fear.
"What is it?" Eekman asked.
Kerim Gürsel saw it first.
"This," he said, as he leaned forward to pick something up. "Don't touch it, sir."
Baran flinched away.
"It's witchcraft." "Oh, don't be so—"
And then Eekman saw what Kerim had in his hand. It was the devil. More specifically, it was his mother's devil tarot card. He looked up at the front of the Negroponte house and noticed that Madame Anastasia's window was directly above. Chapter 31
"This is a sign for me, isn't it?"
Eekman said. The old woman nodded her head. There was no way Anastasia would have dropped one of Usher Ignan's precious tarot cards out of her bedroom window unless she had a purpose. Ignan took one of her skinny brown and purple hands in his. I know it's hard for you to talk.
Then leave her alone!
Ignan turned and looked at Yanis Negroponte, who stood in the doorway to his mother's bedroom.
She's demented, he said. She can't do anything. She probably threw the card out without even knowing what she was doing.
Ignan looked at Kerim Gursel.
Get him out, please, Sergeant.
Yes, sir.
Yanis Negroponte had already been warned when he tried to stop Ignan entering his mother's bedroom. Now he screamed,
No!
Kerim enlisted the help of one of the constables and took Yanis out of the room. Ignan looked into the old woman's deep black eyes. I know it's hard for you to speak, he said, and I know that I should understand what the message you have sent me means. But you're going to have to help me. He smiled. I'm not my mother. I can't read people's minds. She smiled back. Madam, if I remember correctly, the devil in the tarot deck indicates deception.
In part?
So someone is deceiving? You? She said nothing. Her injuries all those years ago had rendered her functional only at times. Ignan looked down at the devil card again.
Scapegoat?
He looked up into her hands again. Yes, that's another interpretation, he said. The fact that the devil has the hooves of a goat means we can make him the reason why we do bad things, rather than taking responsibility for ourselves. She grimaced. In the few audiences he'd had with Madame Anastasia, Ignan had recognized when she was straining to say something. Frustrated, she beckoned him forwards. Ignan put his face close to hers, and she scratched his cheek lightly with one twisted finger. He shook his head.
What do you mean?
He could hear Yanis arguing with Kerim outside. He heard Kerim say,
If you want to be arrested, carry on.
She heard it too. Ignan saw the panic enter her eyes, and then she took a deep breath in.
Prisoner,
she said.
Prisoner?
Where?
Here.
In this house. She scratched his face again and said,
The walls.
Professor Bozdar put a hand on his chest.
It's the Red Room, he said.
Yes, Ignan said. I know.
I don't think you do, the professor said. What do you mean when you say the words Red Room?
A rather extraordinary, in my opinion, Byzantine room, made entirely of porphyry, Ignan said. He touched the stone as if to make his point. Professor Bozdar had to be in late middle age, and yet he ran around that room like a child.
Yes, but it's also the Red Room, he said.
Yes, Ignan really wanted to get on with the process of somehow dismantling the walls. That was why he called the museum, so it could be done under academic supervision, if possible. Because if someone was trapped behind the tons of porphyry in the walls, he'd have to prioritize that person's survival, whatever objections Professor Bozdar might make. A forensic team already had a listening device, normally used after earthquakes, slowly moving across the surfaces.
The Red Room, the only entirely porphyry-dressed room in the whole empire, was where Byzantine empresses gave birth to future rulers, Bozdar said. That is what being born to the purple means. When one was born to the purple, one wasn't just royal. One was also born in this room. Arguably, it was the most important room in the great palace. And one of the reasons why women could sometimes rule the empire unopposed was because they were born in this room. Dr. Safa's favorite study, Empress Zoe, was born here. This is the Byzantine archaeological find of the century. You do know this?
Professor, I have reason to believe that someone is being held hostage behind one of these walls, Igmen said. I'm very impressed with what you've told me. I'm amazed, actually, but I have to get this person out. I asked you here to advise how we might do this without wrecking the place.
I accept you need to find where this person is, Bozdar said. But I do hope you won't just break these precious walls down without...
That's why we've got the listening equipment. It picks up noises the human ear can't, Igmen said. If the team hear anything they think might be signs of life, I will have to give the order to break down whatever conceals it.
Smash up the walls.
Igmen saw him shudder. Unless we can get it off in blocks or sheets, I know nothing about it. How thick is it? Do you know?
Porphyry was very expensive, Bozdar said. It comes from Egypt, and so it had to be mined, transported, and then fashioned by expert craftsmen. In Hagia Sophia, which is all I have to measure this amazing place by, the stone literally dresses the walls. It was rendered into thin slivers, using silk as a cutting tool. Absolutely niche technology. Brilliant.
You imagine this stone will be thin like that?
There will be brick or ordinary non-decorative stone blocks behind it, I imagine. The porphyry will have been fixed to that with mortar, and so immense care will have to be taken when loosening it. If, as I suspect, these sheets of porphyry are thin, then you risk cracking them if you try to wrench them off. I can't stress more forcefully,
Inspector Igmen. What? Ali Bey, head of the forensic team, held the headphones he had been wearing out to Igmen. Maybe rats, but I can hear something.
And there's something here that could be a cavity.
His partner, a female officer, looked into Igmen's eyes.
It's only small.
Igmen took the headphones and listened. For a moment he heard nothing, and when something did come, it wasn't much more than a click, which could have been anything. He gave the headphones back. Then he turned to Kerim Gursel. Get Harker Bey and Mr. Negroponte down here.
Yes, sir.
What are you going to do? Professor Bozdar asked.
Igmen said to Ali Bey, could that sound be human, given your experience with this equipment? Ali Bey put his head on one side. He wasn't sure.
Professor Bozdar said, if there's any doubt...
Well, Igmen said. Ali Bey sighed.
Given what I've heard through this device before, I'd say it's a being, he said. I think I got breathing, but as I say, it could be a rat or a bat or...
What are you going to do? Professor Bozdar said.
Igmen stayed silent. Kerim Gursel and two constables escorted Yanis Negroponte and Harker Bey into the Red Room.
All right, no time to waste, Igmen said.
He put his hand on the wall.
This is hollow, and we can hear some sounds that might be human. Last chance. Do you know if anyone is imprisoned behind these walls?
He'd asked them separately when he'd first worked out what Madame Anastasia had been saying to him. They had both said the same thing. They didn't know what he was talking about. This time they said nothing.
Igmen walked up to Yanis. I know what this room is now, he said. It must be very special to you.
Yanis turned his head away.
But I'm going to have to break down that wall, Igmen said. I'm going to have to damage the Red Room, he heard Professor Bozdar say.
Oh, my God!
And because we think a person might be trapped behind that wall, we're just going to have to smash our way in there. Igmen continued.
He studied both their faces. And if we do find someone in there, we are going to talk again. Neither of them so much as flinched. Igmen told Kerim to take them away. Professor Bozdar grabbed Igmen's arm.
For the love of God, you can't just smash your way in, man. This room is priceless.
Igmen patted the professor's hand. We've done our best, he said. But if a human being is in these walls...
But why would that be? Bozdar said.
He knew very little of the background to what was about to happen, so of course he was confused. Because an old lady says she can hear scratching sounds?
There's more to it than that, Igman said. All I will say is that the Negropontes have enemies. Now I'm going to have to request a team to come and get this wall down. Professor Bozdar began to cry. Once Igman had called for technical assistance, he phoned Mehmet Suleiman.
There was such a simplicity in the faith of the people around her that it made Mary want to weep. Women of all ages, she was only surrounded by women, looked up to the Prime Minister, who smiled at them and told them that everything was going to be all right. Gezi Park was under control now, and he would personally make sure that anyone who had damaged property or injured police officers would be brought to justice. A lot of people waved banners. One said, "Let's ruin this big plot." In spite of trying to keep abreast of recent political developments, Mary had been distracted by the disappearance of Ahmet Erdin, so she wasn't entirely sure what the reasons behind the Gezi protests were. She asked a woman next to her.
"Oh, it's a secular plot, that is," the woman said. "Those old generals who used to run the country want to do so again, but we won't let them."
"No."
She'd heard Mr. Erdin talk about them, the secular opposition, his voice full of contempt. He told her once that when he was a child and the army ruled the country, there had been curfews, religious people had been put in prison for no other reason than their faith, and some of them had subsequently disappeared. The AK party had redressed the balance. Mary felt inspired. The women around her were tactile and friendly, and they shared their food and drink with her and with each other. These were good, kind people. Why had anyone ever wanted to hurt them? One woman explained. "It's because there are more of us than them," she said. "If God wills, we have more children, and we bring them up to be good Muslims, and that is a much more powerful thing than to be a godless soldier."
"Yes."
Everyone had come to hear the Prime Minister speak, which he did, at length, and with passion. Some men in the crowd shouted out their desire to go to Gezi and finish off the traitors in the park. Mary, brought to tears by the ardor people were exhibiting, screamed her desire to join them. Professor Bozdar had gone into the garden. Kerim Gursel had taken him out at Eekman's request. As soon as the stonecutters had arrived, he tried to get involved, so he'd had to go. But as the professor had predicted, the porphyry in the red room was thin. Underneath it was undressed stone, and below that were bricks. Eekman joined Suleiman in the Negroponte's kitchen. Suleiman offered him a cigarette.
"Why do you think that Madame Anastasia's imprisoned individual is down here?"
Eekman took the cigarette and lit up.
"Because of the tapping in the walls," he said. "The house is largely wooden. Where could you imprison someone in a structure with such a thin skin?"
"Who do you think is in there? Heard it?"
Eekman shrugged.
"He's still missing."
Stone cutting began again in the red room. When the technicians stopped to clear the detritus away, Igman said,
"You know, that room in there is the red room, where only true Byzantine emperors and empresses were born. It was part of the great palace. Why is it under this house?"
"The Negropontes have lived on this site forever," Igman said. "They must have taken it upon themselves to preserve it. I imagine that when the city was first conquered, people knew where the Red Room was. Land levels rise over time, so after a while it got lost."
"Do you think that Ariadne Sava found it?"
"I don't know. But if she did, then I wonder whether she found it with or without Yanis Negroponte's knowledge."
"You're thinking he might have killed her, because she knew about this place?"
"You know the lengths he went to protect this place," Igman said. "All those optical illusions. This place means something to these people that we can only glimpse. History is always written by the victors, isn't it? We forget about the losers and what was important and sacred to them. We throw their magic into the dustbin of history."
"Inspector Igman, you need to see this. Now!"
The voice came from the red room. Igman looked at Suleiman. They both got up and walked into the dark, porphyry space together. Chapter 32. He'd been almost dead. He still was, in spite of the machinery that was keeping him alive. Ahmet Erdin was a type 1 diabetic, and he hadn't eaten anything since he'd disappeared. He was also dehydrated, unconscious, and, when he'd been found, covered in his own excrement. The only things that had been discovered with him in the cavity where he'd been bricked up were an empty jug of water and the remains of a candle. How long he'd been in complete darkness was unknown, but whoever had put him there had done so with his suffering in mind. "I can understand why you hate Mr. Erdin," Igmen said to Yanis Negroponte, "especially now I know how important your home is to you. How'd you do it, Mr. Negroponte? How'd you get Erdin to come to the house without any of his people? Was it at night?" Yanis Negroponte said nothing. He declined the offer of a lawyer, opting instead for silence. Igmen plowed on. "Do you even know? Or did Huckabee do it all? He's done most things for your family over the years. Not now, though. Now he's with Inspector Suleiman, and I believe he's talking." He wasn't, but it was never a bad idea to put doubts into a suspect's mind about his fellows. Yanis Negroponte didn't react. He stared at the table in front of him, in the same way he'd done ever since he'd entered the interview room. Igmen looked at Kerim Gürsel and shrugged. "Well, Sergeant, tell me what I can do. I have a man here who won't talk about another man who was imprisoned in his house. Can't see that you can avoid charging him with imprisonment and attempted murder, sir," Kerim Gürsel said. "Or maybe actual murder," Igmen said. Yanis looked up. "He could die, Yanis." He looked down again, and then he said, "Who is looking after my mother?" "We're looking for Huckabee's son, Lokman," Igmen said. "She knows him. In the meantime, social services have become involved. She's not to go into an old age home. If we find Lokman and he agrees to care for Madame Anastasia for the time being, she won't," Igmen said. "If not, I don't know."
"There's her priest, Father Diogenes," Yanis said, "at the Aya Triada. Why can't I go home?"
"I've told you," Igmen said. "You are here because we found an almost deceased, missing person, Ahmet Erdin, imprisoned in your house."
"Has Erdin said I put him there?"
"No. He can't speak. He's in a coma. He may never speak again, but hopefully we'll be able to recover enough evidence from the scene and beyond to be able to convict someone." He leaned on the table. "Tell us what you know, Yanis. This terrible thing happened in your house. You must know something. The Red Room is the most precious part of your home. You know everything that goes on in it." Yanis Negroponte closed his eyes and went silent again.
"I could have beaten you so hard your kidneys explode."
The old man looked at Mehmet Suleiman without emotion.
"We're looking for your son. When I get hold of him, I could do what I want with him, too. He lives in the East. I could charge him with terrorist offences."
"Do what you will, Mehmet Bey. I can't tell you anything about the Erdin mine."
Mehmet Suleiman sat down. Then he put his legs on the table in front of Huckabee and lit a cigarette.
"You've worked for the Negropontes all your life," he said. "Why?"
"My father worked for them, and his father."
"Why?"
"Madame's grandfather, Bacchus Bey. He took my grandfather in."
"Why?"
"It was a hamal," the old man said, "carrying things for rich people. Bacchus Bey wanted him to take a bed from Sirkeci station to his house. My grandfather did it. But when he got to the house, he was exhausted. He'd been wounded in the war against the Arabs. One of his legs was twisted and partially paralyzed. Bacchus Bey gave him a job in his garden and my grandmother a job in the house. When my father grew up, Bacchus Bey gave him work, too. Madam's father continued the tradition. Then, madam.
And what about your son? What about Lockman? Will he work in the Negroponte house when you die?
No. It's different times now. He works for his father-in-law on his farm. He has another life.
Silliman smoked. I suppose the Negropontes must be running out of money now, he said. Mind you, should they decide to exhibit the Red Room? I do know what it is, you realize, Hakube. I know how important it is, too.
You are an educated man.
It's where the Byzantine emperors were born. Being born in that room meant that you were automatically born to the purple, and so could legitimately rule the Byzantine Empire. When Ahmet Erdin was pressing Mr. Negroponte to buy the house, did he know about the Red Room?
We have always kept it to ourselves, Harker said.
Yes, but did he know about it, somehow?
We kept it to ourselves, he reiterated. Why?
I think I ask the questions, Suleiman said.
Yes, Mehmet Suleiman Bey.
But I'll take it. He took his feet off the table.
You ask why?
Because anyone would have to be either truly full of hatred or fearful almost beyond reason to do what has been done to Mr. Erdin. Walling a person up is medieval-style torture. In fact, I think the Byzantine emperors did it to their enemies. Whoever did it to Mr. Erdin wanted him to die, but they also wanted him to suffer. He knew about the Red Room, didn't he? He knew about it and had plans for it you and Mr. Negroponte didn't like.
Harker said nothing.
We'll find out, Suleiman said, whether Mr. Erdin is able to talk to us eventually, or whether he is left without speech or dies is irrelevant to us. Akabe, I know that the Negropontes are your employers, that you feel grateful to them, that there is a connection between you.
But, Mehmegbe, what of Madame Anastasia?
The sudden change of subject briefly threw him. What?
Madam, who is looking after her? She can't be in that house on her own. She can't feed herself.
He tried to get to the old woman when he was arrested. He'd begged to see her, and Chetin Ikmen had asked Madame Anastasia if she wanted to see the old man before he left the house, but she had been very firm that she didn't. She'd seen Yanis, but not Haka. And yet his eyes were filling with tears when he spoke about her.
Madame Negroponte isn't your concern, Suleiman said.
Yes, she is.
No, she isn't. She rejected you, remember? She saw your son, but not you. I know you think you're part of the family, but you're not. You're just a servant. They know it, and so should you.
Akabe began to cry.
Oh, for God's sake! Suleiman stood up and paced the room impatiently. Ahmet Erdin's argument, if you could even call it that, was with the Negropontes, not with you. If Yanis Negroponte walled Erdin up in the Red Room, then it's your duty to inform on him. You owe him nothing. Did he threaten you? Make you help him entomb Erdin?
Narka didn't speak. Suleiman shook his head and sat down again.
You're a sad man, Hakabe, he said. A man who has lost his identity, who doesn't know his place. You've been with the Negropontes for so long, you think you're one of them. You're not. They have abandoned you. Reclaim yourself now, and tell me what you know.
Again, Harker said nothing.
When people's backs are against the wall, Harker Bay, people tend to protect their own. And these people are not your own.
Akabe, no longer crying, raised his head.
Well, that's where you're wrong, Mehmet Suleiman Bey.
Lala Hanum, Ahmet Erdin's eldest sister, was one of those very stylish, covered women. Her scarves were Hermes, and she wore a pair of the prettiest, tiniest Jimmy Choo shoes that Mary had ever seen. Compared to Lala Hanum, she felt like a bag lady. Not that it mattered. Just one room away, Ahmet Erdin lay on a bed, on life support, fighting for his life.
She'd been told that those Greeks he'd been dealing with had tried to kill him by burying him alive behind a wall. The things people did.
Mary looked at Kelimi, happily playing with her Barbie house on the floor. She seemed to have lost not only much of her anxiety about her father in recent days, but also any real notion of his existence. She had been fed. Semih Bey, Ahmed Bey's brother, had said she was to be given everything and anything she wanted. She had her toys and her television. Now she was chattering away to herself, and even laughing. A doctor entered. Semih Erden stood up.
"Are you Mr. Erden's next of kin?" the doctor said. Mary felt her heart squeeze with anxiety.
"Yes," Semih said, "but you can say anything you need to all of us."
The doctor looked around the small, stuffy room with emotionless eyes.
"Ahmed Bey is suffering from a condition called diabetic ketoacidosis. It's serious."
"We know," Semih said. "What are you doing about it?"
His tone was aggressive. Mary wondered whether it was just because he was so worried about his brother, or because the hospital and its staff were foreign. There was a rumor going round that the Germans were behind the Gezi protest, and this was a German hospital. It was also one of the best in the city.
"Mr. Erden has some swelling of the brain tissue," the doctor said. "We are trying to reduce that. Also, the kidneys have been compromised, and so we are giving him dialysis."
Lala Hanum looked confused. Her brother looked as if he was about to explain, when the doctor said, "Due to the insulin deficit that he suffered, his body is breaking down. We are trying to arrest this process."
"So will he be, if he survives?" "I cannot say what his prognosis might be," the doctor said. "When the brain swells, there is always damage. Time will tell."
Kelimi, in her own little world of Barbie, chuckled. The doctor left, and Mary went to the toilet so she could cry her heart out on her own.
"When we find Harker's son, who is probably in some goat-fucking settlement with a broken gearbox, we will ask him what he knows," Eggman said. "But it's intriguing."
He lit Silliman's cigarette, and then his own. Other guilty smokers also haunted the car park, looking shifty. Eggman always made sure that he didn't look in the least bit guilty, and smoked openly and effusively.
"When Harker's grandfather went to work at the Negroponte house, he brought his wife with him," Silliman said. "The couple were childless, which, Harker claims, was down to his grandfather. Following this logic, when Barkus Bey had an affair with Harker's grandmother, she got pregnant."
"With Harker's father?"
"Yes."
"Did he say any more than that?" Eggman said.
"Said he was one of the family, and then he clammed up," Silliman said.
"If he is a member of the Negroponte family, he won't say anything against them, will he?"
"No. But, Mehmet, the fact remains that we found Erden in that house, in a room the Negropontes have kept secret, one way or another, for possibly centuries. Who else could have put him there? And have some faith in the forensics. There will be evidence of Yanis or Harker, or both, inside that...
what did you call it?
Burial chamber?"
"Death niche."
"You didn't find forensic evidence for any Negroponte involvement with Dr. Ariadne Sava?" Silliman said.
"No."
"But then maybe they didn't know her," Eggman said. "Maybe there's some other porphyry room hidden somewhere in this city that only she knew about. This is Istanbul, Mehmet. Anything is possible. You know, Professor Bozdar told me that there are more classical Greek ruins in Turkey than there are in Greece."
"How was Professor Bozdar when you left him?"
"Like an excited 5-year-old. I did think I'd have to tie him down or put him in a cell to stop him telling the world about the Red Room."
Silliman smiled. "How did you persuade him?"
"I told him that if he started telling everyone about it, they'd want to see it, and he'd have to beat them off with a stick to get to it. Not that I think that's true."
"You don't?"
"I think that some people may well want to see it, but others won't. To turn Hagia Sophia back into a mosque mob certainly won't. If Ahmed Erden didn't know about the Red Room, he was going to get a nasty shock when he eventually bought the Negroponte house."
"Not that I think he didn't know."
"You don't?"
"No. For all his talk about the need for a truly luxury hotel in the old city, with the Four Seasons just down the road, what was he trying to prove?
And why the Negroponte house? Why not the Arlan's place next door, or as well as? Harker Bey himself told me that Erdin's father, Taha, was fanatically xenophobic. Ahmet's not exactly on board with multiculturalism, is he? I know he's an Hagia Sophia, must be a mosque nut. He frowned. You know some of them pray behind Hagia Sophia? Yes. Tell no one. But my wife included, Igmen said. He rolled his eyes. She saw Harker Bey and his son on her way there the other day. She said she thought he was going to pray somewhere. He's a Muslim, of course, Suleiman said. His antecedents have been kept secret. Ah, secrets, yes, Igmen said. What damage they do, eh? We all have them, Chetin. Sometimes for very good reasons. I know. Igmen still had a few. He'd once had a lot more. His sergeant had a big secret. He'd have to talk to him about that one day. He cleared his throat. So Harker Bey is a Negroponte, and we therefore have to assume that he won't give us Yanis.
Ah, but wasn't there something about Yanis Negroponte being an impostor?
Years ago, yes, Igmen said, and I thought that Harker was suspicious of him. I think he may still be. But the other aspect to consider here is Harker's feelings for Madame Anastasia. He loves her. She loves Yanis. He won't betray someone she loves.
He loves her.
He rescued her from the mob in 1955, and he's looked after her ever since, Igmen said. I'd say that was love. And she was very beautiful. I remember her well. And they are related. They are connected, Igmen said. The only thing that I find truly odd is the way she refused to see Harker when we left the house. He'd been her right hand for almost 60 years. Why would she turn on him now? A doctor came to take something called DNA. He was an odd little man, with that pale red hair typical of some of the southeastern Kurds. Harker let him take mouth swabs and a blood sample. The doctor explained that the DNA would tell the police everything they wanted to know about him, including his ethnic background. He didn't care. So they'd find out he was Greek, so what? He knew that anyway. He'd not been as Greek as Nikos Bey, which was why Madame had rejected him. But that didn't matter anymore. The doctor left. Then he heard another door open somewhere outside. For a while there was no sound, but then he heard raised voices. He thought one of them belonged to Yanis, but he couldn't work out what he was saying, or even if it was him. The cells were full of protesters from Gezi Park. The place was full to bursting. Alone, all he could think about was why Madame had suddenly rejected him. Chapter 33. Ahmed had hundreds of emails. Semi would require help to answer them. But initially he needed to separate the urgent post from the trash. For some reason there was a load of stuff about Byzantine emperors, specifically about the last one, Constantine Palaiologos. Why? Had the end of Byzantium also been part of his brother's obsession with the wretched Negroponte family and their room? He discarded it all. When he first saw the email from the DNA search team, he thought it was rubbish too. But then he opened it. He wished that he hadn't. He'd understood and gone along with Ahmed's plans for the Negroponte house for years. In a way, he'd agreed with them. But he'd also known what they were based upon, and he'd never been comfortable with that. Semi only just remembered his father, Taha, as a man who had been short on patience and would quickly resort to violence if his children disobeyed him. The story with the Negropontes was that Semi's grandfather, Resat, had been offered a job by the then head of the family, Bacchus Negroponte. Resat had been a builder, and the job he had been promised was gardening, but work of any sort was hard to come by at the time. However, this offer was suddenly withdrawn, and the job given to Harker Bey's grandfather. Why it happened was a mystery, but Resat Erdin had accepted it as the will of God and never bore the Negropontes any ill will. Unlike his father. Years of poverty had followed the loss of that job, which Taha never forgot. And in 1955 he'd paid back all and any Greeks he could get his hands on.
in blood. He'd also held in his mind what his father had said about a secret Byzantine room in the Negroponte house. It was, the old man had told him, a great marvel he must never tell anyone about. The last great Byzantine relic. But Taha had told Ahmed, who had seen the famous room, and promised his father that one day he would destroy it. Which was exactly what Taha had wanted. It was great revenge. And now, here was a report on what was described as a very small blood sample, taken from someone his brother had described as male, allegedly ethnically Greek. Who else could it be except Yanis Negroponte? How had Ahmed got his blood? Semi Erdin read it, and then he read it again. Yanis Negroponte had been arrested, along with Haka Bey, for the attempted killing of his brother. Soon one or both of them would almost certainly be charged with his murder. A phone call from the ward doctor that morning had let Semi know that his brother was fitting. The swelling in the brain, in spite of their best efforts, hadn't reduced, and the doctor wanted to know if he could administer diamorphine to alleviate Ahmed's distress. Semi knew what that meant. Once he was on regular doses of morphine, the end wouldn't be far away. Lala and his other sister, Rabia, were at the hospital all the time. Semi wanted to be, but someone had to run the company, and he'd have to get used to it. What he'd also have to get used to was not having to do as his brother told him. On the one hand, this made Semi want to cry, but on the other, it placed a piece of steel in his soul. He'd never wanted the Negroponte house. There were so many better places the company could build a hotel. So those Greeks had the red room of the Byzantine emperors. Good luck to them. His grandfather, Resart, had always had a great affection for that family. The bad blood raised by his father had only served to make Ahmed crazy and bring about this tragedy he was sure Yanis Negroponte hadn't sought. He could even see now why he'd tried to kill Ahmed. He also decided that it wasn't his place to tell the police about that. They'd find out in time. They performed DNA tests themselves. Semi deleted the email. Pale and hollow-eyed was how Çetin İgmen would have described Kerim Gürsel. Without looking up from his paperwork, he said, "Events in Biolu keep you awake last night, Kerim?" After the government rally in Kılıçeşme, police action in the Biolu area had increased. A lot more people had been injured, including some of the doctors and nurses who'd gone to Gezi to treat the wounded. Samson Bayraktar, ever the fount of all knowledge, had phoned İgmen at 2 a.m. to tell him that, "You're a lot of punching medics now." İgmen knew he needed to speak to Kerim. Yanis Negroponte, who had refused to give a DNA sample the previous evening, was apparently having his breakfast in his cell and wasn't due to come before İgmen and Dr. Selim for a second, hopefully less fraught, attempt at DNA testing for another half an hour. But how to start? For a few minutes he thought about all sorts of things he could say to introduce the subject of Kerim's sexuality without causing the young man to panic. But he couldn't. "Kerim?" He looked up. "Sir?" "Kerim, what I am about to say to you is out of concern and not prejudice or accusation." The pale face became still paler. "Sir?" "Kerim, I know that your marriage is one of convenience. I know your wife is not, unlike you, a lover of men." He saw Kerim's head sink slowly down into his shoulders. "Oh, God, how do you know?" The way he didn't even try to deny it made İgmen admire him. "It's not important, and it isn't a problem," İgmen said. "Not for me. But you want me to resign because of other people?" "No. Oh, no, no, no, no, no." İgmen stood up and paced his office. Then he opened his window and lit a cigarette. "No, Kerim, I don't. That's the last thing I want. After the death of Sergeant Fastakolu, well, you've... Kerim had made him feel something like himself again. "Kerim, I want you to know that I will always, always fight your corner.
And, for what it's worth, I don't believe you'll have any problems with Commissioner Tekir, either. But we live in what the Chinese call interesting times, which means we have some real challenges in our lives now. I want to tell you to be careful.
Yes, sir.
There's nothing I'd like more than to see you at the World AIDS Day March. I go every year with my cousin, who lost a partner to AIDS. But you must be careful. You're still a young man at the beginning of your career, and, sir, you don't have to... You have not replaced Aisha. I still miss her, Igman said. I always will. But I'd miss you, too. Selfishly, I don't want to go through that again. Kerim, you can be open with me. And you must. There was a lot of noise coming from somewhere. Igman shook his head. Why do we have cells creaking under the weight of protesters? See what I mean about interesting times. His office door flew open and smashed against the wall. Commissioner Tekir, her hair unusually loose and tangled, put a blood-stained hand on the doorframe. Igman shot to his feet.
Down to the cells, now, she said.
The pistol lay 2 meters away from the body, which lay face down underneath the cell window.
How did he get it? Igman said.
He asked for tea, Tekir said. Sergeant Courtemanche brought it to him.
Igman had seen Custody Sergeant Courtemanche weeping.
He didn't know it had gone, Tekir said, not even when he heard the shot.
He was a stage magician, Igman said. They can take your balls without your knowledge.
He put a hand up to his head.
Yanis Negroponte had fought to refuse a DNA test the previous evening. Now they could take as much of his blood as they wanted, but he'd blown a hole in his skull, and so whatever the results, they would never be able to ask him what those results might mean.
God!
A crowd of officers stood behind him, jostling for position, trying to have a look. Igman, annoyed by their prurience, elbowed one in the stomach.
Dr. Sarkisian is on his way, Tekir said.
Voices from other cells demanded to know what was going on and who had been shot. Someone shouted,
Fuck it, shut up!
Igman moved away from the cell. Looking at the weeping Korkmaz, he felt nothing but rage. He told the custody officers, including Korkmaz, that Yanis Negroponte was a tricksy fellow who had been a stage magician back in Germany.
"Didn't you listen to what I said about that man?"
he asked. Korkmaz cried harder. "It's no good fucking crying now." He turned to the other officers. "And someone check on the old man, Huckabee. If he decides to top himself, we'll never know what happened."
"Sir, there is the victim," Kerim began.
"Oh, God, what? You believe in miracles now, do you, Sergeant Gussel? Give me strength."
He walked away.
If anyone wants me, I'll be smoking myself to death in the car park.
Logman Atasu and his family had only got as far as Kayseri in their ancient truck. Although the gearbox hadn't broken, as Chetin Igman had predicted, the exhaust had blown and the local police had eventually found him at a breaker's yard, looking for a cheap replacement. When he heard what had happened to his father, he agreed to go back to Istanbul. He took his wife and children with him. They arrived at Hucker's flat in the afternoon, then Lokman went to see Madame Anastasia. It was odd seeing police officers stationed outside the gate of the Negroponte house. A covered woman, who said she worked for social services, took him into the salon, where he met a smart police officer called Suleiman. He asked Lokman to sit down, which he was reluctant to do because he knew he had some oil on his clothes. He put some newspaper down, and then he sat.
I'm afraid I have some bad news for you, Suleiman began.
Dad?
No, your father is still in custody, but he's all right. No, I'm afraid that not only is the man we found imprisoned in this house, Ahmet Erdin, dead, but Mr. Yanis Negroponte is dead too. He committed suicide.
Lokman began to shake. Yanis Negroponte had been in police custody, and everyone knew what happened to people in cells. Everyone knew that suicide could be a euphemism.
Does Madame Negroponte know?
No. The officer was looking at him in a way that seemed to suggest he wanted Lokman to tell her. She is an old lady and very fragile, Suleiman said.
Dad will have to tell her. She might be all right if he does it.
Madame Negroponte won't see your father, Suleiman said.
That didn't make sense.
Why not?
We don't know. We thought that maybe you could tell us.
No.
Suleiman leaned forwards.
Your father has told us that he, and so you, are related to the Negroponte family through your grandfather.
He'd never been comfortable with that. He wasn't ashamed. In fact, he was proud. But he'd always felt it undermined what he considered his identity.
Yes.
An illicit connection, but valid.
I don't know much about it,
Lokman said. Dad never behaved as anything more than a servant. He didn't abuse it. What happened between his grandmother and Bacchus Bey was wrong. But we are who we are. Our blood isn't pure.
Unlike Madam's.
No.
Lokman, what do you know about the Red Room?
He knew they'd found it. The police in Kayseri had said that the property developer, Ahmet Erdin, had been found walled up down there. They'd said his father had done it.
Lokman knew nothing about that.
What he did know about was bad enough, but he didn't know about that.
It's where the Byzantine emperors were born, he said. The Negropontes and us protected it. It's all part of the Greek past. Christian. But it's also part of me, you know?
Did you feel that Mr. Yanis Negroponte was part of you, too? Suleiman asked.
It's thought that your father has always been suspicious about his origins.
Yeah. When he first came, we were. But Madam said she recognized him immediately. I think Dad thought he was not trustworthy because of the magic. And he couldn't believe that the baby Yanis had survived.
What do you think?
He shrugged.
Don't know. I wasn't born in 1955.
Story was that a Turkish woman stole a baby from the back of the Negroponte's shop. Madam said she saw her. Dad's always had his doubts.
Lokman, we have taken samples from Yanis Negroponte for DNA analysis. You know what that is?
Yes, it's to find out who someone's related to.
Yes. So in order to find out if Yanis was Madam's son, we need to compare his samples to hers. It means taking blood from her. This is obviously a delicate matter, and normally we'd ask your father to help persuade her. But
she's got a doctor. You could ask him.
We could, but we think that...
Lokman, someone will have to tell Madam that Yanis is dead, and
I can't do it. I can't.
But who else can? If we tell her, the shock may be too great. You are at least a relative.
Of call her doctor. I don't know how she'll take it. We were never close, not like her and Dad. Why won't she speak to him?
I don't know.
You see?
He won't say.
Lokman shook his head.
I'd ask you to speak to him, but...
No, no. I'll see him, but I can't make him say what he won't. I can't make him do anything. I never have. He's always only thought about her, Madam.
I don't matter, Inspector. Not really.
The smart policeman sighed.
Well, Lokman, then can you tell what, if anything, you know about a woman called Ariadne Sava?
Lokman felt bile rise in his throat. It made his denial sound fuzzy.
Are you sure you've not heard that name? From your father, or from Yanis Negroponte?
No.
It wasn't cold in that room, but Lokman felt chilled, and he had to wait a long time for the policeman to stop looking at him, which was hard. But eventually Inspector Suleiman said,
Okay. Now are you all right looking after Madam for the time being?
As long as I don't have to be the one... To tell her that Yanis is dead,
yes,
Lokman said.
I understand.
Did the policeman see that his brow was slathered in cold sweat?
Mary had to tell Kelime that her father had died. She had to explain what death meant, but the girl didn't understand. In the end, her uncle Semi told her that Ahmet had gone away on business. She wouldn't see the funeral, None of the women in the family would.